Chapter 17. Mr. Rickham wanted to see it, she began, as if excusing herself. He shrugged his shoulders, still smiling. Oh, Rickham found me out long ago, he said lightly, then, passing his arm through mine, colon, come and see the rest of the house. He showed it to me with a kind of naive suburban pride. The bathrooms, the speaking tubes, the dress closets, the trouser presses, all the complex simplifications of the millionaire's domestic economy. And whenever my wonder paid the expected tribute, he said, throwing out his chest a little, colon, yes, I really don't see how people manage to live without that. Well, it was just the end one might have foreseen for him. Only he was, through it all and in spite of it all as he had been through, and in spite of, his picture so handsome, so charming, so disarming, that one longed to cry out, colon, be dissatisfied with your leisure. As once one had longed to say, colon, be dissatisfied with your work. But, with the cry on my lips, my diagnosis suffered an unexpected check. This is my own lair, he said, leading me into a dark plain room at the end of the florid vista. It was square, and brown and leathery. No effects. No bric-a-brac, none of the air of posing for reproduction in a picture weekly above all, no least sign of ever having been used as a studio. The fact brought home to me the absolute finality of Jack's break with his old life. Don't you ever dabble with paint anymore? I asked, still looking about for a trace of such activity. Never, he said briefly. Or watercolor or etching. His confident eyes grew dim, and his cheeks paled a little under their handsome sunburn. Never think of it, my dear fellow, any more than if I'd never touched a brush. And his tone told me in a flash that he never thought of anything else. I moved away, instinctively embarrassed by my unexpected discovery, and as I turned, my eye fell on a small picture above the mantelpiece, the only object breaking the plain oak paneling of the room. Oh, by Jove! I said. It was a sketch of a donkey, an old tired donkey, standing in the rain under a wall. By Jove, a Stroud! I cried. He was silent, but I felt him close behind me, breathing a little quickly. What a wonder! Made with a dozen lines, but on everlasting foundations. You lucky chap, where did you get it? He answered slowly. Mrs. Stroud gave it to me. Ah, I didn't know you even knew the Strouds. He was such an inflexible hermit. I didn't till after. ... She sent for me to paint him when he was dead. When he was dead. You? I must have let a little too much amazement escape through my surprise, for he answered with a deprecating laugh, colon, yes, she's an awful simpleton, you know, Mrs. Stroud. Her only idea was to have him done by a fashionable painter, ah, poor Stroud. She thought it the surest way of proclaiming his greatness of forcing it on the purblind public. And at the moment I was the fashionable painter. Ah, poor Stroud, as you say. Was that his history? That was his history. She believed in him, gloried in him, or thought she did. But she couldn't bear not to have all the drawing rooms with her. She couldn't bear the fact that, on varnishing days, one could always get near enough to see his pictures. Poor woman. She's just a fragment groping for other fragments. Stroud is the only whole I ever knew. You ever knew? But you just said, Gisburn had a curious smile in his eyes. Oh, I knew him, and he knew me, only it happened after he was dead. I dropped my voice instinctively. W, when she sent for you? Yes, quite insensible to the irony. She wanted him vindicated and by me. He laughed again, and threw back his head to look up at the sketch of the donkey. See, there were days when I couldn't look at that thing, couldn't face it. But I forced myself to put it here, and now it's cured me. That's the reason why I don't dabble anymore, my dear Rickham, or rather Stroud himself is the reason. For the first time my idle curiosity about my companion turned into a serious desire to understand him better. I wish you'd tell me how it happened, I said. He stood looking up at the sketch, and twirling between his fingers a cigarette he had forgotten to light. Suddenly he turned toward me. I'd rather like to tell you, because I've always suspected you of loading my work. I made a deprecating gesture, which he negated with a good-humored shrug. Oh, I didn't care a straw when I believed in myself, and now it's an added tie between us. He laughed slightly, without bitterness, and pushed one of the deep armchairs forward. Tea there. Make yourself comfortable, and here are the cigars you like. He placed them at my elbow, and continued to wander up and down the room, stopping now and then beneath the picture. How it happened, I can tell you in 5 minutes, and it didn't take much longer to happen. I can remember now how surprised and pleased I was when I got Mrs. Stroud's note. Of course, deep down, I had always felt there was no one like him, only I had gone with the stream, echoed the usual platitudes about him, till I half got to think he was a failure, one of the kind that are left behind. By Jove, and he was left behind, because he had come to stay. The rest of us had to let ourselves be swept along or go under, but he was high above the current on everlasting foundations, as you say. Well, I went off to the house in my most egregious mood, rather moved, Lord forgive me, at the pathos of poor Stroud's career of failure being crowned by the glory of my painting him. Of course I meant to do the picture for nothing, I told Mrs. Stroud so, when she began to stammer something about her poverty. I remember getting off a prodigious phrase about the honor being mine, oh, I was princely, my dear Rickham. I was posing to myself like one of my own sitters. Then I was taken up and left alone with him. I had sent all my traps in advance, and I had only to set up the easel and get to work. He had been dead only 24 hours, and he died suddenly, of heart disease, so that there had been no preliminary work of destruction. His face was clear and untouched. I had met him once or twice, years before, and thought him insignificant and dingy. Now I saw that he was superb. I was glad at first, with a merely aesthetic satisfaction. Glad to have my hand on such a subject. Then his strange lifelikeness began to affect me queerly as I blocked the head in. I felt as if he were watching me do it. The sensation was followed by the thought. If he were watching me, what would he say to my way of working? My strokes began to go a little wild. I felt nervous and uncertain. Once, when I looked up, I seemed to see a smile behind his close grayish beard, as if he had the secret, and were amusing himself by holding it back from me. That exasperated me still more. The secret? Why, I had a secret worth 20 of his. I dashed at the canvas furiously, and tried some of my bravura tricks. But they failed me, they crumbled. I saw that he wasn't watching the showy bits. I couldn't distract his attention. He just kept his eyes on the hard passages between. Those were the ones I had always shirked, or covered up with some lying paint. And how he saw through my lies. I looked up again, and caught sight of that sketch of the donkey hanging on the wall near his bed. His wife told me afterward it was the last thing he had done, just a note taken with a shaking hand, when he was down in Devonshire recovering from a previous heart attack. Just a note. But it tells his whole history. There are years of patient, scornful persistence in every line. A man who had swum with the current could never have learned that mighty upstream stroke. I turned back to my work, and went on groping and muddling. Then I looked at the donkey again. I saw that, when Stroud laid in the first stroke, he knew just what the end would be. He had possessed his subject, absorbed it, recreated it. When had I done that with any of my things? They hadn't been born of me, I had just adopted them. Hang it, Rickham, with that face watching me, I couldn't do another stroke. The plain truth was, I didn't know where to put it, I had never known. Only, with my sitters and my public, a showy splash of color covered up the fact I just threw paint into their faces. Well, paint was the one medium those dead eyes could see through, see straight to the tottering foundations underneath. Don't you know how, in talking a foreign language, even fluently, one says half the time, not what one wants to, but what one can? Well, that was the way I painted. And as he lay there and watched me, the thing they called my technique collapsed like a house of cards. He didn't sneer, you understand. Poor Stroudy just lay there quietly watching, and on his lips, through the gray beard, I seemed to hear the question. Are you sure you know where you're coming out? ... If I could have painted that face, with that question on it, I should have done a great thing. The next greatest thing was to see that I couldn't, and that grace was given me. But, oh, at that minute, Rickham, was there anything on earth I wouldn't have given to have Stroud alive before me, and to hear him say, "It's not too late, I'll show you how"? It was too late it would have been, even if he'd been alive. I packed up my traps, and went down and told Mrs. Stroud. Of course I didn't tell her that it would have been Greek to her. I simply said I couldn't paint him, that I was too moved. She rather liked the idea, she's so romantic. It was that made her give me the donkey. But she was terribly upset at not getting the portrait she did so want him done by someone showy. At first I was afraid she wouldn't let me off, and at my wit's end I suggested Grindel. Yes, it was I who started Grindel. I told Mrs. Stroud he was the coming man, and she told somebody else, and so it got to be true. And he painted Stroud without wincing, and she hung the picture among her husband's things. He flung himself down in the armchair near mine, laid back his head, and clasping his arms beneath it, looked up at the picture above the chimney piece. I like to fancy that Stroud himself would have given it to me, if he'd been able to say what he thought that day. And, in answer to a question I put half mechanically each in again, he flashed out, "W and the one thing that brings me anywhere near him is that I knew enough to leave off." He stood up, and laid his hand on my shoulder with a laugh. Oh, only the irony of it is that I am still painting since Grindel's doing it for me. The Strouds stand alone, and happen once, but there's no exterminating our kind of art. The potboiler, the studio faced north, looking out over a dismal reach of roofs and chimneys, and rusty fire escapes hung with heterogeneous garments. A crust of dirty snow covered the level surfaces, and a December sky with more snow in it lowered over them. The room was bare and gaunt, with blotched walls and a stained uneven floor. On a divan lay a pile of property's limp draperies, an Algerian scarf, a moth-eaten fan of peacock feathers. The janitor had forgotten to fill the coal scuttle overnight, and the cast-iron stove projected its cold flanks into the room like a black iceberg. Ned Stanwell, who had just added his hat and greatcoat to the miscellaneous heap on the divan, turned from the empty stove with a shiver. "By Jove, this is a little too much like the last act of Bohème," he said, slipping into his coat again after a vain glance at the coal scuttle. Much solitude, and a lively habit of mind, had bred in him the habit of audible soliloquy, and having flung a shout for the janitor down the 7 flights dividing the studio from the basement, he turned back, picking up the thread of his monologue. "Exactly like Bohème, really, that crack in the wall is much more like a stage crack than a real one, just the sort of crack Mungold would paint, if he were doing a humble interior." Mungold, the fashionable portrait painter of the hour, was the favorite object of the younger men's irony. "It only needs Kate Aaron to be born and dying," Stanwell continued with a laugh. "Am much more likely to be poor little Casper, though," he concluded. His neighbor across the landing, the little sculptor, Casper Aaron, humorously called Asper on account of his bronchial asthma, had lately been joined by a sister, Kate Aaron, a strapping girl, fresh from the country, who had installed herself in the little room off her brother's studio, keeping house for him with a chafing dish and a coffee machine, to the mirth and envy of the other young men in the building. Poor little Gaspar had been very bad all the autumn, and it was surmised that his sister's presence, which he spoke of growlingly as a troublesome necessity devolved on him by the inopportune death of an aunt, was really an indication of his failing ability to take. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.